Distributing the Future broadcast August 28, 2006. Ownership.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. We continue to present portions from the O'Reilly Radar Executive Briefing. Tim O'Reilly talks to Chad Dickerson about Flickr and open services. Erwin Gross looks at the rising tide of intellectual property. And Roger Magula shows what's on the technology radar. Think of all the stuff you own. What do you think it weighs? That kind of feels like a silly question, but consider this. 10 years ago, if I had to add in the weight of all the music I own, there'd be lots of pounds taken up by records, cassettes, and CDs, and now a lot of what I own are MP3s and WAV files. They don't seem to weigh much at all. The total value of what I own has gone up quite a bit in the last decade, and the weight hasn't increased that much at all. This weight metric is useful. It pushes us to realize that more of our possessions and more of what we offer the world can't be packaged and shipped off somewhere the way we used to. Our notions of how best to protect our stuff has also changed. Suppose I have a television that you want. Now, believe me, you really don't want our TV, but play along with me for a moment or two. If you take my television, then now you have it and I don't. It's a theft that costs me. Now, you could copy my music without my permission, of course, and I haven't lost anything. You've gained something, but now the loser is the record company and possibly the artist. Okay, now think about pictures that have been uploaded to Flickr. Once they're there, other people can comment on your pictures. These comments become part of the experience. You still own your pictures, but who owns the comments? Can another company come along and, even with your permission, transfer your pictures and maybe even the comments to their service? Today we'll look at intellectual property rights, and we'll look at the challenges for companies like Flickr who are trying to be open services without giving away the store. But first up, Roger Magulis, head of O'Reilly Research, looks at recent technology trends. He explains that he looks at a lot of different views into the market: book sales, job listings, geographic data, delicious tags, but he cautions...
The basic technique is to use visualization to spot and explain trends. So as you'll see, as we'll see something going up or down, it doesn't mean anything without context. So this is a tree map view. So this has basically two dimensions. The size of the squares represents the number of books. The color represents the change. And so we look at the big green ones and the big red ones to see what's going on with this. When we look at jobs, Web 2.0 is the biggest growth area in technology that, from our calculations, and Ajax, Ruby, down there is a big growth area. And you can see some of the things that are going on. One, you can see when C# had its new release, there's quite a big increase, just like it wasn't a big increase, but there's an increase in Java. So those are kind of the big stories. I also want to point out another thing about different maturity levels. With Java and C#, they're relatively mature, and so when a release comes, there's immediate motion in the book sales. But stuff like Ajax and Rails, it takes a little while because they're new, and also I think because they're open source, and there isn't like pre-release information on them. Okay, so we look at the relative share of the two things, and we see that the new version of C# has gained a lot of interest. But then we compare it to job growth, and we say, well, the interest is in that it's a new version. It doesn't necessarily translate into expanded market share. We also looked at Delicious, and again, we see that the C# has gone up, but more of the tagging is in the Java world, so it's coming from a small base. I think it's remarkable in the book sales that Ajax has surpassed PHP. We know that there's a lot more PHP development going on, but certainly in the short term, the interest is really great in these areas. We also see that relative to the rest of the job market, that both Ruby and Ajax have big growth rates. With the books, we're able to look a little bit on why people are buying the books. What's the topic behind it? We think this says something about the products themselves. So you look at MySQL, a lot of the books are PHP and MySQL books that we see. And so you see a lot of web development. You look at Oracle, a substantial amount are about DBAing and tuning, because Oracle is a complicated product to tune with a lot of exposed levers and knobs to push. And then SQL Server has done a good job of putting in report services and analysis services. And so there's a lot of people are buying books about that because they're separated out. Now, you look at the job market, the picture is pretty different than what we see in books, where the open source products are smaller and lower. And I think part of this is that when you look at the job market, the folks who are advertising more tend to be larger companies, and they have settled more in the commercial product so that they can yell at someone in the middle of the night. So now I'm pointing out things that, you know, we've seen a bunch of times where we've shown that these are things we're interested in. One is this VoIP and asterisk. I think there's an interesting thing about VoIP and asterisk is that we think a lot of folks are going to be putting these in. There's a lot more small business creation in the U.S. Over the last couple of years, and gosh, everyone is going to need one of these. But you only need one per office. And so it's not going to be like we're a database where a company might run 70 databases or 1,000 databases if they have a data-intensive operation. You don't need that many phone systems. But we do think there's going to be a big revolution in how phone stuff is used. We see there's been some books coming out on VoIP and asterisk, and we see some interest, but we expect to see more talk about it. With VoIP, it's clearly of interest all over the country. Asterisk, still more on the coasts. And then jobs, and this is probably for us the most leading indicator, is we are seeing greater job growth in these areas than the job market overall. Virtualization, Tim said before, we do think it's going to change a lot, but it's something that doesn't maybe show up as much in books and stuff. So here's our virtualization book sales. Virtualization has obviously been around a lot. There's some hardware support issues, and I think that's starting to change. We look at the jobs, and there we do see more of a leading indicator in jobs in this case, where it has been outpacing the regular job market. And then we look at web traffic from Alexa, and we see that there is increasing evidence with two of the sites that support virtualization. I really think everyone who's in IT is going to be dealing with virtualization over the next few years. There's too many compelling resource and energy issues to ignore it. I want to talk quick about iPod. Is what does it mean when you can engage your customers so broadly? Is that you get a curve like this. This is iPod books. Now, an iPod has basically four buttons on it. There isn't that much to write about. Yet people are buying a lot of books on it. And just to put it in context, Here's some other areas. I mean, I have Photoshop Elements. It's a lot more complicated to use than iPod and iTunes. So I just think that when you can get to these places, and one of the things with all this technology, I think we all think of as objective rationalists. In reality, I think we're about the same as women's clothing when it comes to fads. And I think that this is part of it. The other thing is, I mean, an iPod came out around here, so it's just been recent that it's really, you know, for this last Christmas season and extended, that it's really gone into this kind of hyperdrive. So I think there's some lessons in whatever you're doing around engagement and marketing and branding of whatever it is you're doing. Long tail. We've talked with Chris. The book has just come out. For us, this is our proof of the long tail. What we're showing here is a bunch of distributions of books, and they might be a little hard to explain, but basically BookScan is retail book sales, point of sale data, and that's the red line in every case. Here. And you can see that in the top 10%, somewhere around 50% of the books are books sold are in that top decile there. And so the curve is very steep. In this case, look at Safari lined up the same way. You can tell it's much more shallow, and we get a little rattlesnake tail at the end here, where some extremely unpopular books, because they're only basically available online, end up getting more traffic. And then if we line them both up by deciles, we still get a flatter curve electronically. So this is our, the long tail is real, and that any kind of electronic, anything where you can take out the distribution and inventory costs, you're likely to get that long tail effect. And that's it.
Roger Magulis, how is it that we need so many books for the iPod when it only has a couple of buttons? Now, the weight metric that I talked about earlier came up in this next piece, a presentation by Erwin Gross called The Rising Tide of Intellectual Property and the Need for a New Marketplace for Rights. He tracks the increase in creative output and considers what we need to do to enable its growth and regulation.
Creative output, something that every member of the open source community is very familiar with, is in fact a lot more important than people give it credit for, not just in the open source community or for the technology industry. Creative output is the single most important factor and perhaps the only important factor driving the growth of the major economies over the next several decades. The mechanisms that we have for taking advantage of creative output, you know, markets of all kinds for trading, sharing, and monetizing that creative output, in a word, are broken. We really have all sorts of problems with them. I'll detail a few, and it's costing us billions of dollars a year. It's going to get worse if we don't do something about it. And then finally, I'll finish up on a hopefully more optimistic note by observing that I think that there are things that we can do about it. Whatever form creative output takes, whether it's a new theory of physics, a new mode of transportation, or a lousy movie, creativity's byproducts have one thing in common. They all originate from ideas. And that means that our creative output is something quite different from the output of our physical labor. It's easy enough. You can ask my six-year-old. He'll tell you that you can't put your arms or your hands around a good algorithm the way you can a popsicle. All of our creative output is intangible. And because it's intangible, it finds its principal economic identity as intellectual property. There are a lot of rules and regimes here: trademarks, copyrights, patents, and trade secrets, just to name a few. They're very complicated, and they support an entire industry of people who interpret them. But at their core, all intellectual property boils down to one simple thing. It's a collection of rights. Basically, rights exercised by the creator or a subsequent owner to restrict or take advantage of specific creative output. For most of human history, there's been a lot of creating and inventing, but at the end of the day, when it comes time to exchange hard-earned dollars, what people are exchanging those dollars for are physical goods, tangible stuff. In the case of people, things like food and clothing, and in the case of businesses, things like raw materials and heavy machinery. In 1969, the U.S. gross domestic product, roughly speaking, everything of value produced in the United States that year, weighed 758 billion pounds. 30 years later, in 1999, the U.S. GDP weighed about the same. But, and here's the important thing, in inflation-adjusted dollars, so in real terms, the value of the GDP in 1999 was more than three times the value 30 years earlier. That means that every dollar of output produced in the United States weighs 70% less than that same dollar of output 30 years earlier. We make fewer things and more intangibles, stuff like the software created by the people in this room, film, entertainment, business services, stuff that doesn't weigh anything. On the surface, that sounds relatively straightforward, but it is freighted with meaning. Once again, returning to Chairman Greenspan, his observation was that the economic product of the U.S. in a very short time span of 30 years has gone from physical things and the human labor that creates them to output that is predominantly conceptual. It's an enormous change, one that we haven't really witnessed before. It turns out that over the same 30-year period, the volume of global trade has increased in excess of 350%. But if you do the same sort of analysis on global trade, what you find out is that 99% of the weight of global trade is carried by boats and trains, things like steel, lumber, coal, ore, etc. The remaining 1%, things like pharmaceuticals, microelectronics, and Louis Vuitton bags, are carried by air cargo. So air cargo amounts to about 1% of the total weight of world trade. But as of last year, it now equals more than 40% of the total value of that trade. What we have here sounds pretty good. We've got creative output from people like the people here in this room, and we see the beginnings of a very significant shift in our economy to take advantage of that. But all is not well. Everywhere that you look, when you start talking about transacting in intellectual property rights, you find all sorts of problems. Foremost among them is the notion of uncertainty. You know, pretty much everywhere you look, people want to know what rights belong to whom and whose rights trample on the others. You run into frustration over conflicts, deep conflicts, in the policies that we have as a society put together. We have a climate of distrust as it pertains to intellectual property transactions. It makes it a very, very difficult world in which to share and trade. You know, open source is very much an exception to the rule as it pertains to traditional maintenance and trading of intellectual property rights. And all of that, unfortunately, leads, somewhat predictably, to conflict, specifically in the context of IP, to incremental litigation, what the economists call transaction costs and what I used to call in my old job billable hours. We have incredibly poor information today about intellectual property assets and intangible assets. We don't know who owns these things. For example, many of you presumably have heard about Google's book project. They want to digitize and index all of the books ever written. And, you know, there's a dispute currently with the publishers about who has the rights to do it and so forth. But the fact that I want to bring to your attention today is that both sides acknowledge that for 75% of the books ever written, nobody knows, not the publishers, not Google, no one knows who owns those rights. We have enormous transactions costs associated with trying to get deals done on intellectual property and intangible assets of all kinds. You know, there's a basic question. What's it worth? It's not all bad news. Not everything about the intellectual property system is a disaster. We have actually seen some progress. Over the course of the last several decades, we've seen organizations like ASCAP and BMI begin to set up working, functional trading systems for certain types of intangible property rights. In this case, radio and TV broadcasting. We've seen new business models, things like iTunes and YouTube, beginning to take various types of intangible rights that used to be completely off limits, where really the only access, certainly in digital form, was piracy, and begin to take those rights and come up with mechanisms for distributing them. We've started to see securitization experiments. So some years back, David Bowie and an enterprising group of bankers bundled together intangible rights in some of his future work. Dunkin' Donuts just did this with some of their franchise rights. Not plenary solutions, but certainly important ones. We've now begun to see the beginnings of formal auction processes for intellectual property so that it becomes possible to ascribe value to particular patents by looking at comparables. Having said that, though, I think there still remain some pretty fundamental open questions. Open source is terrific, as are many of these other initiatives, but at the end of the day, we still have a lot more to do. So what's next? What can we do to fix or enhance the systems that we have for trading what arguably will be our most important types of assets? One thing we need to have is transparency. We've got to know who owns these rights. We've got to have a mechanism for recording them when they're transferred so that it becomes possible to know who to negotiate with. And this was incredibly painful when we had to do it as a society in the 17th and 18th centuries for land. You know, land offices were very hard to set up and very expensive. We're very fortunate now that we have, technology like the Internet that enables us at very low cost, to design and execute systems for bringing transparency, and something I think is vital to being able to have an organized market. We need to have better participation. Again, historically, this has been done in a very top-down manner by the government. It's a closed system where you've got overworked, underfunded agencies that are cut off from communities like this one that can provide valuable input and help us prevent, the issuance of patents on swing sets to five-year-olds. We've got to fund this effort correctly. I don't know what the precise correct level of government spending is here, but I can tell you that what we're spending today almost certainly isn't enough. We've got to have mechanisms for valuation. And once again, the intangibles community can take a lesson from the open source community. A crucial component here is that we've got to have openness about what valuations are. We're not going to have a market until we have pricing information that enables people to feel like they can trust what they're paying. And finally, we've got to have engagement, right? But we need to participate in helping to define the rules and defining the standards, ensuring that the transactions that ought to happen in the creative output that we all put so much work into actually do happen, and defining the ground rules for the trading, monetization, and sharing of what may well be the most important new asset class of our time.
Perhaps it's unfair to Gross, but I also want to include the first question which was asked of him by Pam Samuelson, who teaches at UC Berkeley. She said that she found the presentation
quite interesting. It's just that I have no idea what you're actually recommending. So could you be more specific? Are you talking about forcing all copyright owners to register their copyrights immediately in any transfers, or they lose all their rights? Are you talking about an orphan works kind of system? Are you talking about just throwing more money at the patent office? I don't actually see how that's going to get us to a lighter clearing trading rights trading system, and so I wonder if you could be a little more specific, at least give an example. If you bring up ASCAP and BMI, I won't be very persuaded, because most of the people that I know think that those systems are pretty bad, and that there are actually a lot of disadvantages to trying to extend that particular model. So a little bit more precision would be helpful to me.
Gross said that he didn't have time to adequately respond. There's been a bit of a controversy with respect to the Flickr APIs. What if a company created a business out of collecting all of the share-alike photos from Flickr and offered them up on a DVD? What about another company that took advantage of Flickr APIs to allow you to move your own photos from Flickr to their service? The answers that arose in this conversation between Tim O'Reilly and Yahoo's Chad Dickerson might not be what you expect. The issue is fair commercial and non-commercial use of the Flickr APIs.
So Coop is an example of a commercial API partner who we use when you see the order prints button on Flickr. Non-commercial for developers, pretty much anyone can sign up for. Anyway, we got a request for a commercial API key from Zoomer, which is a photo sharing site. And initially, Stuart Butterfield, who's one of the co-founders of Flickr, along with Katarina Fake, immediately denied it. Well, then it hit TechCrunch, and this is starting to sound a little bit like high school, but then it hit TechCrunch, and there were a lot of people commenting back and forth saying that Flickr was afraid of Zoomer and so on and so forth. So in the end, after a lot of public discussion, Stuart came to the conclusion that instead of denying the API key to Zoomer, he set forth what I've been calling around the office the Butterfield Doctrine. That is, we will give you a commercial API key if you give us a commercial API key to your API. And of course, as far as I know, last I checked, Zoomer didn't have an API, which I think sealed the deal for the short term. But I think from a Yahoo perspective, and I think from the web perspective and Web 2.0 perspective, it's actually a good thing to promote reciprocity in this way. Stuart, in some of his comments, compared it to the GPL, which enforces freedom kind of down the line. So,
how do we redefine open in this world? And there's a principle that's right there in one of our open source licenses that you're now saying, okay, let's see how that translates to the world of web services. You know, reciprocity. Okay, yeah, you can suck stuff off our site if we can suck it back.
You know, Stuart's a brilliant guy, and it came completely out of his head. But I run the Yahoo Developer Network, and we manage all the APIs across Yahoo. I'm going to the groups within Yahoo and suggesting that this is a good way to do business. If there is some sort of open services definition, open data definition, I hope this is part of it.
Yeah, that's actually something I'd love to sort of just put out to this group, anybody who's interested. I think it's really time for us to take the principles of, you know, the open source definition and ask ourselves, how do they translate? And maybe work up an open services definition. I know there's some work on open standards definition, but I don't think that's necessarily the same because, of course, right. Flickr is not a standard. It's you know, your app. And you know, at the same time, you're working very hard. There's a couple of things. Users should be able to take their data. You know, they've invested time, you know, whether it's Delicious, another Yahoo property now. They put their bookmarks in there. How do they suck them down? How do they get them back? And actually, we make it easy for people to export their own data.
In the end, the people who wanted us to approve a Zoomer commercial API key were most concerned about the tags. When it really got reduced down, everyone knew that they already had their photos on their hard drives before they uploaded to Flickr, but they wanted their metadata back.
Has Yahoo given any thought to just how you use Creative Commons as part of your mechanism?
Right now, in the case of Flickr, not so much of the other properties, you can choose a default license for your photos, or you can go in and change the license on a per-photo basis.
So what's the default license now?
I think the global default is all rights reserved.
Okay.
But it's kind of interesting. This gets to sort of the judgment calls that come with granting API keys. We've seen API requests come in for essentially stock photography companies that are requesting to use the Flickr API to dump all the Creative Commons photos on Flickr onto a CD and sell it.
So that's that any different than people sort of pulling down all the bits for a Linux distribution and selling it, which is how the Linux marketplace got
going? It's a valid use based purely on the license, but in some cases the users have not been fully educated on the licensing, and when they start seeing their photos showing up in unusual places,
that's fair. It's a lot easier for somebody to just get sucked into.
Yes.
That without thinking about it. But again, there's something very interesting here, the idea that, you know, Creative Commons really was an IP tagging mechanism. You know, the idea that you can associate a license directly with each piece of data that goes out.
I think open data extends, obviously, beyond Flickr. I think Flickr, as Tim has noted, and the Zoomer situation was kind of the first shot in the open data wars. But I think...
By the way, I just wanted to clarify. I don't think Zoomer wanted to use this so they could bulk download all of the Flickr photos to Zoomer to jumpstart their community, or so that individual users could say, import all my Flickr photos to Zoomer?
It was actually the latter.
Okay, so in one sense, it really is still at the behest of the individual user, which is why it seems a bit more legit than if they just wanted to sort of jumpstart their Flickr competitor.
Right. But I think it's important to note, I mean, as Stuart noted in a lot of his comments, that a company like Flickr or within Yahoo is running a business and does want to protect that to some degree. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Zoomer, and this is, I've actually signed up for Zoomer, and it's an interesting service, so this isn't to denigrate them. It was an unproven service. The API with Flickr is an authenticated API that in certain cases will allow deletes. So I don't think we were confident completely that in migrating, I think an example would be if Zoomer migrated the Flickr user over and then decided to, say, delete the photos on the Flickr side because they were done and there was a bug, we felt like that might actually come back to Flickr and not Zoomer. So mm-hmm. we have to make calls in those areas.
Can you think offhand in your position at Yahoo of where do you see the greatest potential for data lock-in?
That's a good question. I mean, and it's a hard question because in my role, I don't even think about locking data in. Mm-hmm. My role in working with teams like Flickr is to think the other way.
Right, but so, there's still a lot. And this is an example not from Yahoo. Right. Unfortunately, from your point of view, I don't use Yahoo Mail. But, for example, I use Gmail. And I was looking at uploading my address book from Mac OS X, and I go, oh, crap, you know, they only read in, you know, comma delimited. How dumb is that?
Right.
You know, it's like an Apple, of course, doesn't export comma delimited. You know, they only export, V cards, right? So is it deliberate?
That's kind of like the when did you start beating your wife question. Is it deliberate or are they not thinking? I would have to go with the not thinking.
Now, in the case, but again, the real issue there, I mean, so there's two issues there. One is, Google not reaching out and saying, okay, we have to be inclusive in the formats that we import. Now, again, I think actually a lot of this would really work in the open data space if we followed John Postel's robustness principle. You know, be rigorous in what you put out, be liberal in what you accept. So import, you should import anything you can. And export, you actually should put out as much as you can too. But, you know, at the very least, make the comprehension side work well.
And I think, I mean, a lot of what we've been focusing on is export.
The point you mentioned earlier, though, that where I said taking it out of context, using Delicious as an example, if I can take back my bookmarks, that's all very well. But I'm back in the situation I was before I had Delicious. I have my own bookmarks.
Right.
And the value is in the collective work. And I guess this is part of my belief why open data, just like open source, is not a problem for a company that's trying to protect its intellectual property assets, because ultimately the network effects in the data make the collective database so valuable that at some point starting over just doesn't make any sense unless you have a really different value proposition.
The network effects built through the community are actually where the action is. And the data is important. You want to be able to get it in and out. But I find that when I try to pull my data out when I'm successful in a highly networked application where all my friends are, it's an empty feeling. So that's where, you know, I think sort of the positive aspect of something like Flickr is that in a lot of cases, and we heard this from the community in the Zoomer situation, the users want to be there.
Thanks to Chad Dickerson, Tim O'Reilly, Irwin Gross, and Roger Magulis. We'll be off next week for the Labor Day holiday in the U.S. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg, distributing the Future's a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.